I'll just read the translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Lord Brahma, because of material opulence, a foolish person becomes dull-witted and mad. Thus, he has no respect for anyone within the three worlds and defies even my authority. To such a person, I show special favor by first taking away all his possessions." Okay, so read the purport. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. A civilization that has become godless because of material advancement in opulence is extremely dangerous. Because of great opulence, a materialist becomes so proud that he has no regard for anyone and even refuses to accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The result of such a mentality is certainly very dangerous. To show special favor, the Lord sometimes makes an example of someone like Bali Maharaj, who was now bereft of all his possessions. So you can all join me. Om Agyanita Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patita Nam Pavnebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasri Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. So before I begin, I'd just like to let you know that I'm very nervous. It's the first time that I've given Bhagavatam class. And actually, I don't have such a problem generally in terms of public speaking, because my job is such that I'm always teaching and I'm interacting on a public level. But when I have such exalted and senior devotees in front of me, then I feel like I'm shaking inside. So please forgive me, first of all, for if I cause any offenses or say something that is perhaps inappropriate. I'll try my best not to. But at the same time, please give me your blessings, that I can't really, I really don't feel qualified to be here and speaking to all of you. Many of you have helped me to get to where I have got to in Krishna consciousness. So I feel very, very humbled actually being here. So please, if I can have your blessings before I say anything. And of course, the blessings of Srila Prabhupada. So I just wanted to read the purport once again, because it's a very short purport, just to kind of remind us what Prabhupada is explaining. So a civilization that has become godless because of material advancement in opulence is extremely dangerous. Because of great opulence, a materialist becomes so proud that he has no regard for anyone and even refuses to accept the authority of Supreme Personality of Godhead. The result of such a mentality is certainly very dangerous. To show special favor, the Lord sometimes makes an example of someone like Bali Maharaj, who was now bereft of all his possessions. So I really like Prabhupada's first sentence, actually, that a civilization that has become godless because of material advancement in opulence is extremely dangerous. So I think for me, Prabhupada is really trying to highlight how dangerous this world that we live in, where we're constantly surrounded by material opulence or maya, basically the illusion of feeling that we are the controller, that we are the enjoyer and we can enjoy in so many different ways. Just over this last week or so, I've certainly had this desire. Not that I don't have desires all the time, but I certainly had this desire that, you know, I wanted to go and watch a movie. Okay, I wanted to watch Spider-Man 2. Okay, so I haven't been to the cinema for a long time. I have been, but I haven't been for a long time. And I was wondering what has suddenly kind of increased this desire in me all of a sudden. And then kind of when I kind of thought about it and kind of delved a little bit deeper on that particular idea, what I realized, it's advertisement. Okay, because I go to work, I travel on the tube, and pretty much all the tube stations at the moment have these posters of Spider-Man 2. You get out of the tube station and you see buses driving past with the posters of Spider-Man 2. So what I realized that actually, it's all of these things that are just influencing my mind, making me desire that I've got to go see this. It's a good film, etc. But I've never been kind of a massive, fan of Spider-Man or anything like that. So I was kind of wondering why I suddenly had this desire. And then I realized that it's because of all my surroundings, the influence around me. I was watching this YouTube video called The Story of Stuff. I don't know if anybody has come across that. It's a fantastic tool, actually, for preaching and showing. But one of the things, one of the statistics, it's made in the US, but one of the statistics that was mentioned on this particular video is that, on average, a person in the US gets exposed to 3,000 ads a day. Okay, so it's designed in such a way that you are influenced every day that you have to go and spend money. You have to go and enjoy. You have to go shop. Okay, and so these things kind of become quite prevalent in us, and we're kind of forced to think, okay, so I want to, I want to go and enjoy this, or I want to spend my money here, I want to go to buy a shop, I need a new car, I need a new clothes, I need to be with the current trend that's going on. So lots of things kind of push us to think in this particular way. And then what happens as a result of that? That we desire, so we want to fulfill our desires. Okay, but let's face it, these things aren't free. Okay, so we have to then go and work. And so we go and spend all this time working really hard so that we can basically get money to maybe be able to do these few things. But what we realize is that actually how hard we're working, by the time you get home from work, you're exhausted. You're exhausted and you feel like, why am I doing this? I'm so drained. Okay, but it's because your desires are pushing you to work in such a way that you basically want to enjoy. And then what happens? You try and go to enjoy. And whilst you're going through that process, more bombardment of advertising and media gets at you. And so what happens? You get more desires. And so again, you think, now I need to fulfill more things. And what I'm earning, the money I'm earning is not enough. So you go and work harder. Maybe you take two jobs, or maybe you increase your hours. And so you get more and more drained. And at the end of it, before you know it, you're kind of sitting there thinking, what have I achieved in my life? So I really like this point that, that a civilization that's become godless because of material advancement is extremely dangerous. And especially it's dangerous because we're made to think in this way. This is the society that we live in. And so we have to be very careful how much we engage in what society pushes us to actually do. But the second thing, Prabhupada says, is because of great opulence, materialist becomes so proud that he has no regard for anyone and even refuses to accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the point here, that as soon as you start enjoying and you start engaging in material opulence, then you start feeling like I've achieved so much. I've achieved so much, I've worked so hard and I've achieved so much. So look at how great I am. And so you start believing that you're the doer, that you've made all of these things happen. And when that starts happening, then it becomes very dangerous because we start forgetting about who we really are and what our real position is in life, which is that we're not the doer, we're actually just being controlled. We're actually being controlled through the modes of material nature. We think we're the doer, okay? We may have some little will power that we exercise, but actually all of that is influenced by the material modes of nature itself. And as soon as we start thinking we're the doer, then we forget. We forget who we really are, we forget our position, and thereafter, if we forget our position, then we forget the Lord as well. And the result of such mentality is certainly very dangerous. Okay, but the next thing, the final sentence that Prabhupada says, I think is especially struck out to me in this particular purport, which says, to show special favor The Lord sometimes makes an example of someone like Bali Maharaj, who is now bereft of all his possession. So the Lord shows his special mercy. Okay, so sometimes as devotees, we may also, just because we're practicing devotees doesn't mean that, you know, maybe you guys are, but certainly for me, I'm not, you know, on a pure level. So even though I claim myself to be a devotee, I'm still very much exposed to these things and I interact with these things. So it's very, nice. It feels, I feel very loved when I hear that the Lord takes his time out to kind of make that special endeavor and so show special favor to his devotees. And basically today I really wanted to focus on that because Bali Maharaj is a great devotee, right? We accept Bali Maharaj as one of the great Mahajans, known for the level of his surrender, how he surrendered to Vamanadeva. So representing the quality of Atmanivedam. What I thought was quite interesting as well is that the level of challenges that the Lord sometimes puts his devotees before he shows his special mercy, right? So if we think about Bali Maharaj, you know, he tied him up, he completely, absolutely humiliated him, and then looking at how the devotee acts in that particular situation, and then the Lord uses that to then glorify the devotee for how they've done. So we see that with Bali Maharaj. We also see that with his grandfather, right, Prahlad Maharaj. That Prahlad Maharaj went through so much. He went through absolutely, you know, he was thrown into fire, he was thrown off the cliff, so many things that he went through. Okay, so one might question, well, why does the Lord do that to his devotees? You know, his surrendered devotees. But the Lord does that because A, he knows that the devotee can survive the test, and B, he can then make use of that example to show everybody else how to behave. So it's quite important that all of these pastimes are there because we can learn from them. Okay, it's not just there because, you know, the Lord is, you know, quite harsh on his devotees and he wants to put them through troublesome times, but there is kind of something that he wants to teach the rest of us from that as well. So it's important that, because if we externally look at Bali Maharaj and his position, you might look at that and say that, well, Bali Maharaj was kind of the king of the deities or the king of the demons. Okay, so on one sense, you might associate him with demons, basically. But on the other hand, we see that the qualities through these pastimes over the last few chapters have really displayed that although he somehow may have been caught up in the position that he is the king of the demons, but actually internally he was very much, the qualities he had were very much qualities of a devotee. Just like sometimes we have to go to work because we need to make a living and support our family, etc. So we have to go to work and we may be doing jobs that may not be, you know, very favorable for our Krishna consciousness. But maybe for the purpose of maintaining ourselves, we have to do those jobs. But the thing is not to get so caught up in that, that that becomes your life, basically. That you have to realize that this is just an end, kind of a means to an end. Basically. It's just there to fulfill some role in life, which is basically to provide for your family and doing those things. But once you're not at work, then you can really be who you are and really follow on what you want to follow and try and achieve the goals that you want to reach in life as well. So at that point, we have the opportunity to kind of really delve deep into our Krishna consciousness. Just because somebody sees you externally kind of doing some job which may seem like it's nothing to do with Krishna consciousness doesn't necessarily mean that that's who you are internally as a person. So just like that, I'm not qualified to kind of think about why Bali Maharaj was in the position that he was in or kind of to get into a discussion about that. But it's important that although externally it looks like he's kind of the king of the demons or so, but we can see that through these pastimes that actually he was a very great devotee. And therefore, because he's such a great devotee, the Lord is able to show his special favor. Also, we have other examples of similar things as well. So we see in the Mahabharata that we see the Pandavas, right, were sent to the forest for 12 years or whatever that was. And they went through lots of troublesome times. And one of the questions Yudhishthira Maharaj asked Lord Krishna after the war and after he became the king, he asked Lord Krishna that, why did we have to go through that? Why did we have to go through, you know, going through the forest and going through those troublesome times, etc.? And this is what Lord Krishna said to him, which I thought was quite interesting. By the way, just as a kind of a disclaimer, everything I say, I really don't want to take credit for any of it. Anything I've kind of referencing is because I've heard things, I've heard lots of classes building up to this, by His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj, by His Grace Gaur Gopal Prabhu, and many other devotees, some of the devotees who have been giving classes at the manor over the last couple of weeks as well. So just want to repeat some of the things that I've kind of heard from them. So this is what Lord Krishna explained. Lord Krishna says that when I'm kind to my devotees, I award them all kinds of opulence. Okay. But when I want to give my supreme benediction, I take everything away, which I thought was really nice. So it's not that devotees don't receive, you know, sometimes the Lord's favor comes in a way that he gives lots of things, okay, to maintain ourselves, and he gives us lots of opulence. But other times, okay, his higher level of mercy is, you know, something even more than that, is actually when he takes everything away. Why? Because we see in these examples that when the Pandavas had nothing, what were they doing? They were relying 100% on Krishna for providing everything that they had, right? If we look at, if we read and analyze the prayers of Queen Kunti, then what we see her praying, that I wish for more and more of these things to come because I can depend much more on you. So the Lord's favor is considered to be even more so when they take these things away from us, right? And it also, it gives the devotee an opportunity to fully surrender, right? We can also look at, from the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we can look, kind of analyze how the gopis were in absence of Krishna, right? They were completely completely immersed. So when Krishna took himself away from them, who was their kind of prized possession, you know, they lived just for Krishna, then what happened is that you see that the prayers, the type of prayers and conversations that I had, show that they're actually able to think about Krishna even more so. We also see that with the example of Draupadi, in the scenario of Draupadi, that again, you know, you might ask that, why did she have to go through those things? But again, it teaches us the level of surrender, and that when everything gets taken away, because she tried to reach out first to her husbands, the Pandavas, who were in a situation that they couldn't do anything. She then tried to reach out to her elders. So she tried to reach out to Bhishma Dev and Dronacharya and all these very senior personalities within the audience, and they couldn't do anything. And so she realized that I have no other shelter other than Lord Shri Krishna. And then finally, when she surrendered, then Krishna gave her protection in that particular way. So that was kind of the first thing that I wanted to talk about, that Krishna chooses devotees very carefully in terms of who he chooses to kind of use as examples. Because these are devotees that can A, handle the test, and B, that then after passing those tests, Krishna can use it as a lesson for all of us, that what can we learn from it and how can we apply that to our life. The other thing I wanted to kind of do is focusing very specifically now on Bali Maharaj, because obviously we're reading about Bali Maharaj. So there is a very special favor that is being shown by Lord Vamanadev in terms of taking all his possessions and putting him in this position. So one may ask that what were the qualities of Bali Maharaj that allowed or kind of invoked almost Krishna's mercy in this particular way? So I just wanted to rewind a little bit and look at some of the things that have happened up to now and how we can see that as kind of qualities that we can also try to either work towards or perhaps, you know, just something to aspire for and lessons that we can learn from Bali Maharaj's experience. The first lesson, there's kind of three things I want to go through, so hopefully I have time to do that. That the first thing I want to go through is, where did Bali Maharaj get his power from? Okay, so I want to kind of look at a little bit on that. Secondly, I want to talk about when Vamanadev approached the arena where the sacrifice was happening, then how did Bali Maharaj actually receive him? Okay, the qualities in receiving a great personality. And then the third thing I wanted to just briefly talk about is how the Lord tests his devotees. So those are the kind of the three kind of things that I want to try and go through today. Hopefully I'll have time, and hopefully I'll use up my time, so there's no questions, but we'll see. So the first lesson I wanted to look at is, where did Bali Maharaj get the power? Because if we rewind a little bit, then what we see is that Bali Maharaj is attacking the heavenly planets. Okay, so he's coming and he's absolutely fired up, right? To a point that Indra sees him coming and Indra gets frightened, Okay? Now, let's not forget who Indra is, right? He's the king of the heavenly planets. And if we think about this idea of the demons and the demigods, right? This has been going on for a very long time. And every time there's a battle, generally what we tend to see is majority of the times the demons, win the battles and they defeat the demigods defeat the demons. But what we see in this situation is that Indra, the king of the heavenly planets, who's many times defeated the demons, is absolutely frightened. He's shaking, actually. Okay? So what gave Bali Maharaj the power this time? Okay? Because before this, he was defeated. In fact, Bali Maharaj had died until he was brought back to life by Shukracharya, his spiritual master. Okay? So what gave Bali Maharaj this time the power that actually he became so strong? Okay? Anybody? Any ideas? What made him so strong? Sorry? Yeah. So he worshipped Brahma. The principle I was kind of looking at specifically is that, so when he died after the war, etc., and he was brought back to life, then he was very grateful to whom? Shukracharya, who was his kind of guru for bringing him back to life. And what he then did is that he basically followed the instructions of Shukracharya. So he followed the instructions, and basically by following the knowledge that Shukracharya provided him, he basically conducted this yajna, right? This yajna, Vishwajit yajna. And as a result of that, he received very celestial weapons, the type of weapons that, some serious weapons, basically. So when he got these weapons, basically he was almost indestructible at this point. So there's two things here. One thing is that he got the knowledge from his spiritual master, okay? But secondly, he used that knowledge to please his spiritual master and to please the brahmanas. And when he pleased the spiritual master and he pleased the brahmanas, that's where he received his kind of empowerment. That he was so empowered that nobody could defeat him because he had the blessings of his guru and the blessings of the brahmanas. On contrast, okay, you could also say, well, hold on a minute, Indra, Indra is this great king of the heavens. He's a devotee also, right? We've seen Krishna in other situations bestow his special mercy on Indra also. And Krishna wouldn't do that unless Indra was something special also. So how did Indra kind of suddenly become weak against Bali Maharaj? And so there is another pastime, which I don't know in full details, but I've kind of heard in classes that there's another pastime that there was in an arena where Indra was with all the other kind of demigods, etc. At one point, Brihaspati, who's considered to be the guru of the demigods, basically, Brihaspati entered this arena, and Indra was so occupied or so busy that he didn't actually acknowledge, okay? He didn't acknowledge Brihaspati. And so that was kind of seen as an offense, okay? That he basically ignored or kind of didn't acknowledge his guru. And so Brihaspati in his mind actually predicted this, that because of the fact that Indra has suddenly become so proud that he can't even acknowledge his guru, at some point he's going to lose his power. Okay, so we can see the contrast. On one hand, we've got Bali Maharaj, who's pleased his guru and has received such empowerment. On the other hand, we see that somebody who's making an offense to his guru and they lose everything. Okay, so we can see how that link is there as well. And also, we can just explore this idea of knowledge and when knowledge becomes empowered. Okay, so it may be that the guru provides the knowledge, but that knowledge doesn't receive empowerment until the guru is pleased. Okay, and so we see in other examples as well. For example, if we look at Hanuman. So Hanuman, a great devotee of Lord Ram, and yesterday was Hanuman Jayanti, and Jainitai Prabhu was speaking on the glories of Hanuman. And one thing actually that I heard from Gorgopal Prabhu is that there is a section in the Ramayana just after Hanuman realizes he has all these powers and he's about to cross the ocean, etc. And there are certain verses in the Ramayana which Gorgopal Prabhu was explaining that if you first start reading these verses, what it appears like, Shishi Radha Gokulananda ki jai, Shishi Taram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Shishi Gornitai ki jai. So what it appears like, from Gorgopal Prabhu's explanations, is that Hanuman starts to really start kind of talking about his powers, that this is no issue for me, I can easily jump the ocean and do all these things. It kind of seems as though in the initial glance, it seems like Hanumanji is kind of boasting about the powers he now realizes he has. But then Gogopal makes a really important point. Okay, and this is where sometimes we read things, but if they're not in context, we kind of read or get the wrong meaning of this. And Gopal probably explains that if you just stick with those verses, later on, what Hanumanji says is that I have all of these powers because I'm servant of Lord Ram. Okay, it kind of almost seems like he's kind of glorifying himself initially, but actually then he says all of this ability that I have is only there because I'm the servant of Lord Ram. Okay. So it's like, for example, when somebody shoots, like, so recently I'm a little bit caught up in Mahabharata because Mahabharata is being shown at the moment and a lot of devotees are kind of watching Mahabharata and discussing Mahabharata, etc. So you see on Mahabharata that when you have certain situations where you've got some Kshatriya that, you know, shoots an arrow, you know, they make it very kind of illustrious, you know, that the arrow is going very fierce, etc. Okay, so the arrow is very fierce, it's very powerful, but who is shooting the arrow, right? Where is the arrow getting its power from? So it's getting the power from the person who is using the bow and shooting that particular arrow. So like that, the guru is the bow and the person who's kind of shooting the arrow. And then the disciple or the servant is basically the power comes from the guru itself. Okay, but in order to have that empowerment, you need to be pleasing the guru. Another example of this is Krishna and Sudama. Okay, so we hear about the story of Krishna and Sudama when they were in the forest and there's a torrential downpour, etc., and they were kind of stuck. Okay, so they were able to utilize their knowledge to be able to know what to do in that particular situation. And again, why? Because they had pleased the guru, and therefore, although they had the knowledge, that knowledge could be empowered. Whereas in other cases, we see that just because you have the knowledge doesn't mean you always have empowerment. So I've got examples of, well, first of all, Indra. Okay, so Indra offended Brihaspati. So he lost his ability, he lost his knowledge. But the second example, which I thought is very, very useful, is Karna in the Mahabharata. Because Karna is a great warrior, right? But he also, at the stage, offended his guru. Okay? And that was at a stage where he lied to his guru. That although Karna was a Kshatriya, he claimed to his guru that he was a Brahmana. And one point what happened is that there was an insect or some bug that bit him. And because he didn't want to disturb his guru in some way, he tolerated that pain. Okay, but as a Brahmana, you would not have been able to have tolerated that level of pain. Okay, so when the guru realizes this, he notices and he realizes that actually, you're not a Brahmana. You said to me you're a Brahmana, but actually you must be a Kshatriya. So you lied to me. You lied to me. And so therefore I've given you all this knowledge. You're very powerful now, but when you most need this knowledge, you will lose it. And then that's where we see Karna getting defeated in the battle. When he most needed that knowledge, he kind of gets defeated. And so it's important that how we're interacting so that we are pleasing our guru. But that's actually goes more, it's more thorough than that actually, because in some cases, especially nowadays, the gurus in ISKCON are extremely busy. So sometimes many of us don't even have direct association of gurus. So how do we then please the guru? So most gurus say that the way you please them is by A, following the instructions that they have in many classes, and B, by pleasing the devotees around you. And so if you can be doing something that pleases the devotees on a day-to-day basis, thinking about what can I do to please the devotee, isn't it? Sometimes it's very quick that we're doing something and the devotee asks us, Prabhu, can you please do this? And you know, you just finished a service and you're feeling quite tired and now somebody's asked you to do another service. So we feel like, oh, Prabhu, you know, I'm not qualified for this service. You know, maybe this person is qualified or something like that. We try to come up with excuses, etc. So I think we should be mindful of wherever the opportunities that Krishna sends us, all these opportunities, so that we can advance ourselves. And so when these opportunities come, then we should try and make good use of them and try and do what we can. The other thing I wanted to just explore on this, so when we've got the guru's instruction, okay, then the second thing here is that we should follow that with determination. Okay, so all of us have some very common instructions that we can all try to follow, right? Which Srila Prabhupada gave, which is that we chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulative principles and try and do service. So all of those things are opportunities for us to really become determined in our spiritual life. Okay? Because we're in this war against Maya, right? As I said, we live in a world, you know, I mean, at the moment, we're at the manor, so everything is very spiritual, very nice, and we feel like doing devotional service, right? But it just takes, as soon as you're out the manor gates, it hits you. You know, material energy really hits you. And so we have to be very strong to be able to fight against that type of material energy. But we can't fight unless we're determined. Okay, so we have to be determined that whatever services we have, we do it to be able to please Krishna. When we're chanting, we're trying to be attentive, okay, trying to do as much as we can to please Krishna. When we are trying to following our regs, right, it may be difficult, but we've got to kind of persevere and we've got to make sure that we're trying to maintain our principles. And when we do those types of things, then naturally we develop qualities that allows us to please the devotees. And when we please the devotees, we please the guru. And when we please the guru, we please Krishna. And so that then evokes the mercy that then can come from Krishna. It's like Shivram Maharaj said a couple of weeks ago when Maharaj gave class, and he said that, you know, don't think that this isn't available for us. Don't think that, you know, we haven't got the mercy available to us. It's just our choice to whether or not we accept it or not. So that's based on how determined are you and whether you choose to follow Krishna consciousness to the full. And if you don't, then, you know, the mercy is there, but you've chosen not to accept it. And so we've got to kind of be careful and mindful of that. The second thing I wanted to look at is the receiving of Vamanadev. So when Vamanadev approached the sacrifice, because again, Bali Maharaj is very opulent, right? He's got all the opulence. He's the king of the universe. Through the yajnas he's done, he's attained the entire universe. So you can imagine how important as a personality he is, right? He had many brahmanas doing sacrifices with him. But what happened? As soon as Vamanadev entered the arena, everything came to a stop. Bali Maharaj realized and he saw the effulgence. He realized that this is some special personality, and all the brahmanas and Bali Maharaj basically stopped all of those sacrifices and immediately received Vamanadev. Okay. So that's another thing here, that it may be that sometimes, you know, Krishna, because as I kind of quoted, that Krishna says that in some ways his mercy comes also through his opulence as well. So sometimes it may be that we are in a situation which materially it may seem like, you know, we're comfortable. Krishna's provided a lot of different things. But here what we learn is that Bali Maharaj had opulence, but he still didn't forget his responsibilities or how he should, you know, reciprocate or accept the Lord. So sometimes when opulence comes at us, then we forget everything. We get so caught up in the opulence that we forget about where the opulence came from. So it's important to always remember, even in those situations, that we may have this opulence, but who's providing it? Krishna is providing it. And therefore, how am I reciprocating with that? And so Bali Maharaj reciprocates with Vamanadev. He immediately stops. He then receives him. He bathes his feet. Okay, so he thinks about his ancestry, he kind of, you know, his grandfather and other devotees and how they receive senior personalities like this. So he washes and bathes their feet, bathes Vamanadev's feet. And then he realizes that, okay, you've come here, you've come to me, you could have gone anywhere else, you've come to me, so there must be something that you're after. But before I move on to kind of the test, I just wanted to also think about the other extreme here as well. So we look from kind of other pastimes, we see other personalities who also have opulences, but how they're misusing the opulence. So for example, Hiranyakashipu, okay, sticking within the lineage of Bali Maharaj, right? We had Prahlad Maharaj, who went through all this suffering and he was glorified, but then Prahlad Maharaj, his father, was Hiranyakashipu, who also had so much opulence. He had everything. The demigods were fearing him, okay? But how was he using his opulence? He was using his opulence to use it in a way that I am better than God. Okay? The opulence I have means that I can do anything I want and therefore I'm better than God. And so opulence can come and it can also, you know, kind of cause this massive illusion. Okay? But then what happens at some point, whether you accept it or not, you're forced to kind of surrender unto Krishna in some way. The other example is Ravan. Okay? So Ravan also had a lot of opulence. But what did he try and do with his opulence? Well, first of all, he was never satisfied. He always wanted more and more and more. So it teaches us that we have to at some point learn satisfaction. Until we do, we're never really going to be happy. We're always going to want more and more and more. So if you look at Ravan, he had everything. But yet, he still went after Sita. Okay, he had everything, but he still wanted to. And that's another important principle, actually, that if we misuse opulence, then that directly leads into an offense. Okay, so we're rejecting God, not only rejecting God, but we're trying to steal God's property. Okay, so he tried to steal Sita in that particular way. So we've got to be very, very careful that what opulence or what we may have in our life, and how that is then affecting our life as well. And we've got to be mindful that it doesn't become to such a point that you become more, you know, material conscious than Krishna conscious. Because as soon as that happens, then as soon as Maya is in your heart, then that will lead to offenses, either of offenses of devotees or offenses of the Guru or Krishna directly. Jiva Goswami quotes in terms of offenses. Okay, so Jiva Goswami says that if you commit 100 offenses, what that leads to is inattentive chanting. Okay, you cause 100 offenses, immediately you're going to be inattentive in your chanting. He goes on to say that if this increases to 1,000, okay, so once you get to 1,000, then this causes you to break your regulative principles. Okay, and if that becomes 10,000, then you basically lose the chanting process altogether. So you'll completely stop chanting at that point. So we've got to be very careful that we guard against our offenses. So how do we guard against this? Well, by being in the association of devotees. Yeah, we're trying to make sure that whatever we do in life, we are very careful that we have the right association of devotees. And sometimes, you know, it can be that also within devotees that you think that my friend is a devotee, so I'll hang out with my friend. But then actually when you meet, there's not even one sentence that was about Krishna. Okay, it was just about other things. So then, is that really association? Okay, maybe it's better than somebody who's not a friend, who's not a devotee. But the point is to maximize the association you're getting. It's about discussing and helping each other to become Krishna conscious. Okay, so I've got a statement here that says that association, if you have regular association, then it immunizes us against Maya creeping in our hearts. Okay, but otherwise, by making offenses, you're kind of opening the doors. Okay, so quite careful here that by making offenses, you're opening the doors, so you're allowing Maya to enter in. But then by having regular association, you're kind of closing those doors, basically. So you're kind of protecting yourself from Maya coming in. Then we come on to the final thing. I haven't got much time, so I'll try and make this quite quick. So we come on to the final thing, which is that the Lord tests his devotees. Okay, the Lord tests his devotees. And we see that with Bali Maharaj. So Bali Maharaj was tested, and we see two things. First of all, we see how the Lord kind of is very instructive with Bali Maharaj. Because Bali Maharaj, he comes up to Bali Maharaj says, "What can I do for you?" And the Lord says that I just want 3 steps of land. Okay? And at this point, the initial reaction of Bali Maharaj is that I'm so great. I'm so great, and all you're asking me is 3 steps. Ask me anything else, right? This is too small for me to kind of, you know, it's very easy, you know, so give me something more. And so the Lord first gives him some instruction. And he says that, he goes, you need to understand about satisfaction, basically, okay? That when you may have everything, but if you're not satisfied within, then no matter how much you have, you're never going to be happy, okay? Whereas for somebody who's realized and is self-satisfied within, we don't need anything else. We don't need anything else. Simply 3 steps of land is sufficient. Why? Because we're internally satisfied. And so this is also about externally. Whenever you're using any kind of external material objects to try and become happy, to try and please your senses, then the point is the senses will never be pleased. Okay, so you can keep trying, you can keep trying, you can keep trying, right? And we see even someone like Ravan, Hiranyakashipu, they had everything, right? We can try to achieve things, but we're not going to get as far as where Ravan achieved or Hiranyakashipu in terms of their opulence. But yet, it was still not enough. So we can learn from that. It's never going to be enough. So we need to learn that the real happiness comes from within. So first, that was the instruction. Okay? Then came the real test, right? The real test. And the real test was that, you know, so the, you know, the steps are being awarded. So the first steps, Vamana Dev, kind of covers all of the lower planetary systems and the middle planetary systems, etc. The second step, then the upper planetary system and all of the skies, etc. So now there's nothing else left, right? So the Lord here kind of, well, first of all, He says, well, I've got everything. You know, what else can you give me? You're not fulfilling your promise. You told me that you're going to give me 3 steps of land, but you've only given me 2 steps of land. Right? And so therefore, the Lord said, you're not fulfilling your promise. And then there's this process of kind of humiliation. Right? Can you imagine nowadays, if you think about some very famous, some very rich personality, and you humiliated that person, okay, how they would react? Whereas Bali Maharaj, the king of the universe with all the opulences, is being completely humiliated at this point. So he's getting tied up. Okay. He's then getting quite harsh words in the terms that's, you know, in the sense that you're a liar. You didn't fulfill the promise, etc. But the point is that this is a test. This is a test for Bali Maharaj. And the Lord doesn't give a test to his devotee unless he knows that he can pass those particular tests. And so what we learn is how Bali Maharaj then kind of does that. Right. So, now, there is also this dilemma that Bali Maharaj faced as well, right? Before he kind of gave the 3 steps, right? Shukracharya, his guru, told him not to. Okay, so he was in this dilemma that he's got Vamanadev on one hand asking for something, okay, which as a king, first of all, it seems like very small thing anyway. So, and first of all, Bali Maharaj considered himself very honorable. And on the other hand, you've got his guru directly instructing him and giving him some very strong arguments supported by Shastras to say why you don't have to fulfill this promise. You don't have to give three steps. And one of the objections says that if somebody's asking you for something that is going to be detrimental to you, then you don't have to fulfill that, for example. And that's supported by Shastras. So he gives all these Shastric arguments. Okay. But then Bali Maharaj teaches us the example of honor and truthfulness. And he says that, well, he teaches a couple of things through that, but he says, you know, Mother Earth tolerates so much from us. Everyone is abusing the planet, right? So Mother Earth is tolerating so much from us. But the one thing that she can't tolerate is lying or untruthfulness, basically. And he says, I don't want to be that further burden on Mother Earth, and I will follow my promise. And so he says that now I haven't got anything else other than myself, and so I surrender my life. And so you can put your 3rd step on my head. So we can learn from this that now obviously that was a test. That was a test to see, because afterwards the Lord is very pleased. Okay, the Lord is very pleased, and as a result of that, the Lord says, "I'm so pleased that I'm going to grant you various benedictions. One of them is that He grants them that he can live in the Suttala planet, which is considered a lower planetary system." But it's also explained in the Shastras that actually it's the type of a lower planetary systems, but it's so opulent that even some of the demigods wishes they could go there. So externally it may seem like a lower planetary system, but it was actually a very high benediction. And more important than that, as we'll see in kind of later verses, that the Lord then says that not only that, but I'm so pleased that I don't want to go away from you. I want to be in your association for as long as I can. So I'm going to personally come with you, and I'm going to be your doorkeeper of Suttala planet in that particular way. So you can see that the Lord tests his devotees, but then he glorifies them in terms of how they behave. Now, this is a big test. It's a very highly elevated devotee. Sometimes people may say that, Prabhu, you know, I'm not qualified. So, you know, I'm not qualified to even receive the tests of Lord Krishna. But actually, tests come to all of us in some form of way. Okay, so maybe whatever it comes, there are tests. Sometimes the test may be that actually, you know, maybe you sing kirtan very nicely, or maybe you offer arti really nicely, and somebody comes to you and says, that kirtan, Prabhu, was so amazing. You know, you've got the voice of angels from the heavenly planets, and, you know, you devotees have this tendency to sometimes glorify. They go a little bit over the top sometimes as well. So the person who's receiving that might start thinking, ooh, yeah, I really do have a really nice voice. You know, so the point is that that's also a test. That how you react to that. For example, one of the things that I found quite interesting is, again, based on some of the classes I was hearing, one of the things was quoted is a name that was quoted for Radharani. And I think originally it was quoted by Bhagawan Prabhu. And he said one of the names of Radharani is Vidyarthini. Okay? And what that means is that basically you're ever trying to learn. And in the context of Radharani, she's ever trying to learn more and more things in terms of how to please Krishna. Okay, so what we can learn from that is that, I mean, this is Radharani, okay, the eternal consort of the Lord, and she still feels that she doesn't know everything to please Krishna. So she's constantly trying to learn more and more things and different ways to be able to please Lord Shri Krishna. Okay, so what we should take from that is that we should never get proud on whatever quality we may have. We may think that we know something and that pleases Krishna, and we are quite advanced to be able to please Krishna. The point is that Krishna is ever changing, actually, in his qualities and his personality, etc. And so there's always more things we can be doing, and also remaining humble wherever we do have certain qualities to be able to do that. And just finally ending, because we're talking about opulence and how that can be dangerous, just a little story just to finish off as well. It's just a little story that teaches us a lesson. But this story is based on a mother fish and a baby fish, or a little child. And so the young fish, the baby fish, is basically looking at the mother and saying to the mother that we're always in this ocean, you know. But why not we take a trip outside the ocean as well, you know, and see what's going on elsewhere outside of this. And the mother fish says that it's no place for us, you know, no place for us, Beta. No place for us, because actually we can see that, you know, for goldfish, you know, there's lots of goldfish, that stays in this ocean. Unfortunately, I don't know lots of different names for fish, but she says, you know, that there's this fish, that fish. You can see all of these fishes are in the ocean for a reason, because out there, it's only place for one type of fish, and that is selfish. Get the kind of principle. And so therefore, again, we should learn that, you know, material opulence is very dangerous. And so when we utilize it for Krishna, it's okay. When we don't, and we get too engrossed on it, then it becomes very dangerous. We basically can become very proud. If we become proud, then we start causing offenses. If we start causing offenses, we lose any potential we have for advancement in Krishna consciousness. And therefore, using these pastimes like this are there for a reason, so that we learn from these pastimes and we can somehow implement this in our lives. So anyway, that's just what I wanted to say. Again, I just want to beg for any mercy in case I said anything that was offensive in any way. Please thank you for tolerating me. Please forgive me for any offenses I may have caused, and please continue to bless me so I can somehow progress in my Krishna consciousness. So I believe we've run out of time. Is that correct, Prabhu? Yes, okay. So thank you very much. If there are questions, then I'll be around, so you can maybe individually ask me questions. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.